Okay, so this talk is not directed at the people in the Spintronics program, but there are plenty of people here from the Spintronics program, so they're all charged with helping me if I start to stumble. So I've written over on this side of the blackboard several reviews on Spintronics, which is still a very rapidly evolving subject. There is a comprehensive up to 2003 or so review in Reviews of Modern Physics, and to give you an idea of how much activity there is in this area, there are three different reviews on different aspects of spintronics that have appeared on the CONMAT ePrint server just in the last couple of months. And these, among other topics, are the things that people are talking about in the spintronics program. So spin was introduced into quantum physics by Wolfgang Pauli in 1924 when people were studying looking at spectroscopy of simple atoms, alkali metal atoms. And Pauli decided that there was a two-level quantum degree of freedom. And sometime later, people started interpreting this two-level quantum degree of freedom as intrinsic spin of the electrons. Interpretation that Pauli, who I gather was a very opinionated person, resisted for some time. And nevertheless, electrons we now believe do have a two-level quantum degree of freedom. We usually call it spin. And actually, one of the important aspects of spintronics, one that I won't have time to cover in this talk, but it's an important part of the spintronics program, is the two-level spin degree of freedom in solids can be used for coherent quantum manipulation, for quantum information, and presumably there'll be another blackboard talk later in the program, which runs until toward the end of June, which emphasizes more of that aspect. I'm going to talk more about spin electronics, and part of my title, which I made up without a lot of thought, contained the word profit. Parts of spintronics are a technology that has its roots maybe some time ago, but has been transformed by basic physics discoveries in the last 10 or 15 years or so. This is basically, in terms of things that really people sell for money nowadays, is as far as spintronics is concerned, is hard disks, and hard disk technology, information storage technology, is a moderate size business. I think actually I tried to find this out that this is the size of this business is $250 per person. Per year, or no, I think it's actually around $25 per person per year, okay? And so my measure of whether something is economically significant or not is to compare it with what gave me my summer job when I was a kid. And so by that measure, this is an important industry. I looked up the Atlantic lobster fishery. And that size of that industry is about 10 cents per person per year. Okay, so it's pretty big business. And if you have sort of left-wing political inclinations, it's always reassuring as a scientist to understand that it's usually very hard to actually make a profit in technology business. And that's true in this. So the business of making hard disks is actually extremely competitive industry. Hard to make money. The number of companies actually managing to make money has been reduced. And another important good thing about that is the companies that are actually staying in this game are companies that hire PhD physicists to push the technology. Companies like Seagate, for example, have hired many physicists to stay on the top. And I'll explain, as I go along, exactly what this little device is. Okay. So I have to start somewhere in this talk, so I'm going to actually start by saying one thing about different parts of this spin electronics is electron transport. And magnetism-dependent transport, which can be influenced by light. So it involves optics, it involves transport, it involves magnetism. So I'm going to start by trying to say one thing about each of those. And so this is mostly what I'm going to say in the next little bit is what you learn in an elementary or first graduate level course or undergraduate course in solid-state physics. So let me start about by talking one thing, saying one thing about transport theory in solids. The most important thing, the starting point for talking about the theory of electrons moving through solids is to remind recognize a key property of both electrons in solids. Which goes back to the early days of quantum physics. If you want to solve the Schrodinger equation for a crystal, Felix Bloch realized for a long time that it's simple if you solve it by Fourier transformation and that you can look for solutions of the Schrodinger equation for electrons in crystal which are nearly periodic function. So this notation U of R is a standard notation for a periodic function of space in the crystal, a wave function that is invariant under transformations by a lattice vector. And the solution to the Schrodinger equation for electrons in a crystal is a part that's periodic and a plane wave part, the same that you would have for a particle in free space. And so this point of view is actually very valuable for thinking about electrons and crystals, and it's often very useful to think about the Schrodinger equation, not for the real wave function, but the Schrodinger equation for the periodic part of the wave function. And you can see that if the Hamiltonian of a crystal just has a kinetic energy part and a potential part that's periodic in space, that if you want to solve the Schrodinger equation for the periodic wave function, then the Hamiltonian in this point of view is basically, when you take the derivative on the plane wave part, you get an extra factor, an extra term. Actually, okay, so that's usually the best way to look at the quantum mechanics of electrons in a crystal. That all of the wave functions are actually periodic wave functions, so you can just solve the Schrodinger equation in one period of the crystal, one unit cell of the crystal. And the solutions that you need to find are periodic, but the Hamiltonian is actually dependent on a wave vector. And these wave vectors, it turns out, are in inequivalent wave vectors are in the unit cell in reciprocal space of a crystal. Okay, so so one important property that follows from that is that uh, is that the solutions to this Hamiltonian, which we call block states, have a non-zero expectation value of velocity. And so if I write this U, K, the velocity operator, U and K, okay? So this is the solutions of this Schrodinger equation are labeled by a wave vector in the elementary cell of reciprocal space, the so-called Bruin zone. And there can be many solutions for a given wave vector. Those are the bands in the crystal. And the velocity operator in quantum mechanics is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the vector potential. And so you can see that that's the same in this case as taking derivative with respect to wave vector. And so the velocity operator is actually the derivative of the Hamiltonian in this unit cell with respect to the wave vector. And the expectation value of a derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to some parameter is, in quantum mechanics, is just the derivative of the eigenvalue. So the energies of the block states depend on the wave vector in the Bruin zone. So these derivatives are non-zero, and the solutions to the Schrodinger equation have a finite velocity. And what that means is if I have a perfect crystal, and I put that perfect crystal in a current-carrying state by occupying certain block states so that the sum of the velocities is different from zero, current density is sum over all states, let's say, sum over all occupied states, we normally say, times the velocity. If this is, if we prepare the system in a state where the current is non-zero, the current will flow forever, which means that the crystal has no resistivity. So the first thing that you need to, we learn in a solid-state physics course about transport is in a crystal is that what makes the resistivity finite is that the crystal's not perfect due to vibrations or due to imperfections in the crystal. Okay. Now, okay, so I'm going to come back and use this property several times. Next thing I want to say is one thing about magnetism. And I'm going to talk about the simplest type of magnetism, which is ferromagnetism. So ferromagnetism is a rather special type of ordered state in a crystal. And so how do we, what's the simplest way to talk about ferromagnetism in crystals and metals in particular? We can remind of atomic physics for electrons in a crystal. Atomic physics in an atom, you pour electrons into atomic levels, satisfying the Pauli exclusion principle, and fill up all of the atomic energy levels from the lowest energy until you run out of electrons. Same thing happens in a crystal. We have these block states, which have wave vector dependent energies, and we have Pauli's two level quantum degree of freedom, the spin degree of freedom of electrons. For every block state, there are two spin states. And we can calculate the energy of the system. If we had non-interacting electrons, what we would do is we would basically occupy the lowest energy states in momentum space. And the total energy would be integral, let's say, up to the Fermi energy of integrate, occupy all of the states up to the Fermi energy for each spin. So I've written the sum of the energies of all the occupied states as an integral because, of course, in a crystal, these states form a continuum and we characterize the what amounts to the atomic energies in terms of the density of states per unit volume. So this is how many block states I have in a given energy range. And obviously, the energy is minimized if I occupy the spin up states on the left hand side, let's say, and the spin down states on the right hand side up to the same energy. If I'm going to have different Fermi energies for the two systems, then it's going to cost me energy to have fewer spin up electrons in this cartoon and more spin down electrons. So let me calculate this. Let me just take a simple case where this density of states is a constant, so I can take it outside the integral, and the minimum energy in the band is zero. Then this integral is equal to the density of states times the integral up to the Fermi energy of energy, so that's EF up squared. That's the upspin energy per unit volume plus EF down squared. That's the downspin energy per unit volume. So this is for the case where the density of states is zero. This is energy, density of states. And then at some minimum energy, zero goes up to some constant value. That happens, for example, for a two-dimensional system with parabolic bands. Then the number of states with upspin, in this case, is the density of states of upspins times density of states times the chemical potential of upspins and so on for downspins. And so I can write this band energy per unit volume, if I like, by writing the Fermi energy, as the number of particles divided by the density of states. And so this becomes 1 over 2 density of states, n up squared plus n down squared. Okay. And when people do simple theories of ferromagnetism, they usually take account of how polarized the electron system.
Excuse me, you don't really need that in the integral
triangle. No. I've done the integral. Integral of x is x squared over 2. That's one integral I know. Okay. So normally, the density of upspins, people write as the total density times some just dimensionless number that measures how polarized the electron system is. Okay. So this is just the difference between the spin up and spin down density in some dimensionless units. And so for a constant density of states, I can do this integral, express the energy in terms of this quantity C, the fractional polarization, and I get n squared over 4. Okay. So for constant density of states, you can easily calculate explicitly that the energy goes up when the system becomes spin polarized. Just like the energy of an atom would be larger if you occupied only one set of spin states. Okay, so far all I've shown you is something that is obvious from the beginning, and that is if I have a band system, non-interacting electrons in a crystal, the ground state is not spin polarized. And so ferromagnetism occurs because of electron-electron interactions. And we can understand the basically why we have ferromagnetism by considering a very simple model where we have delta function repulsive interaction between electrons. In a real crystal, the interaction between electrons is repulsive, and it's repulsive and it's a Coulomb interaction. But if we approximate it by a delta function interaction, then the energy would be U, which characterizes just the strength of the repulsive interaction, over 2 times the density squared. That would be a mean field approximation for the repulsive energy, except, and this is the key physics of ferromagnetism, its origin is the Pauli exclusion principle, which says that no two electrons can be in the same state. And what that means is that no two electrons of the same spin can be at the same point in space. So that means it's only the interaction between opposite spin electrons that counts in the limit of a delta function interaction. And the interaction energy is the product of the density of upspin electrons and the density of downspin electrons. And so if I use my dimensionless measure of magnetization again, this becomes U over 8, I guess, 1 minus C squared. Okay? So the interaction energy is lower if the system has been polarized, and there's no interaction energy if the system is completely spin polarized, for example, for delta function interactions. And the dependence of the energy of the system on the degree of polarization. Pardon me? N squared here, yeah. Basically, dropping the factors of 2 here, not worrying about them, has a band energy cost of becoming spin polarized, which is small if the density of states is large, if the bands are very flat, and an interaction energy contribution that always favors a polarized state. Okay? Okay, that's a very important point I'll come to in just a second, and the answer is nothing. Okay? And I'll say something more about that in a moment. Okay, so the purpose of going through this is, as you can see here, that if I have non-interacting electrons, the preferred spin polarization is no spin polarization. If I have interacting electrons and the interactions are strong enough, then the preferred spin polarization in this model is complete spin polarization. Now, this model is completely unrealistic, or partly unrealistic at least, but the main message here is true. If a system is magnetic, it tends to be strongly magnetic. It tends to have a large spin polarization. And if, for example, the majority of the electrons are spin up, then the spin down electrons will interact, be repulsed by those, by the spin up electrons, and in effect, the individual electrons see some a strong spin dependent potential. Okay, so there's an exchange potential. We which is basically the difference between the band energy of the majority spin electrons and the minority spin electrons, and the size of the exchange potential is the biggest energy in the system. It's as big as any other energy. It's as big as the width, so-called Fermi energy, which is the width of occupied states in the system. And so it's on like a typical, let's say a typical ferromagnet, the size of this exchange potential is as strong as chemical bonds. It's an electron volt or thereabouts. Okay? And that's very different about ferromagnetism. Ferromagnetism in metals compared to superconductors, for example. High temperature superconductors still have effective potentials, the gap of the superconductor in that case, which is very small. In ferromagnets, it's huge. It's as big as anything. So that's one thing about ferromagnetism. The other thing to say is not only does this this spin polarization not care whether it's up or down. Up was just some arbitrary spin quantization direction. These spins can point in any space, any direction at all. Okay? All the spins line up, and the energy scale that favors them lining up is immense, but the energy scale that tells them which way to point is very small. They are almost, system is almost, but not quite, spin rotationally invariant. And those are both key properties of the real, for the real technological use of magnetism. Okay. And I've used more time than expected, so let me skip one thing. Okay, I just want to say one thing about semiconductors. a lot of what's really interesting in a lot of what people are studying in spintronics is spintronics and semiconductors. What are semiconductors? They're materials in which there's the Fermi level lies in a gap separating two different bands, usually called the valence band and the conduction band. And there's some point in the Brouwer zone, let's say, for example, the point at k equals zero, the center of the Brouwer zone, it's often the case, where the difference in energy between the valence band and the conduction band is as small as it can be. And the Hamiltonian of this system for k near the center of the Brouwer zone, let's say in the absence of an external magnetic field, this is the effective Hamiltonian I wrote down. And this Hamiltonian is, let's say, p squared over 2m. This is the plus v of r. That's the Hamiltonian when k is equal to 0. And then there's a correction term, which at first order in k is p dot h bar k over m. Okay, so this is known in semiconductor physics as a k dot p Hamiltonian. There's another term, h bar squared, k squared over 2n. But let's ignore that if k is small. And the point I want to make is that if I write this Hamiltonian in the basis of the k equals 0 eigenstates, where the higher energy state is the minimum of the conduction band, and the lower energy state is the top of the valence band, then these two bands are coupled together by the K dot P term. And so what this looks like very much is it looks like a Dirac Hamiltonian, where there are two bands with an off-diagonal term like this that couples them. And semiconductor physics then, when we look at different semiconductor materials, the way in which these two bands are coupled together and how far they're separated is very important for their properties. And it's like every semiconductor is a different universe, okay? It's described by some Dirac-like equation, but everyone is different, and every material then has totally different properties. Okay, let me. So, I'm going to try and talk about, with that preface, about two topics that are being actively researched in this spintronics program. The first thing is the spin Hall effect. And first, let me talk about the Hall effect in a crystal. From research on quantum Hall effect, we learned some surprising things about the Hall effect. And let me just try and sketch the expression you'll get from standard linear response theory for the Hall effect and say a few words about it, okay? So let's imagine that I have a crystal where I have an electric field present. And the electric field is, let's say, in the x direction. So I have a perturbation. This crystal is perturbed by the electric field. And I can represent that by a potential that looks like that. And then I can do calculate the Hall effect is that there can be a current response in the y direction. So the current in the y direction expectation value, okay, in the presence of the electric field, I can write this as a sum over states. And I'm going to label the states by my block wave vectors and band indices of the current operator, the y current operator. So this is Vy. In prime k. Okay, so I'm linear response so this is a change in an expectation value is trace of the density matrix times the operator in standard expression in quantum mechanics. And linear response is given by the change in this density matrix in response to an electric field. And just standard linear response theory tells me this is nk dy n prime k. And so this is n prime k. Perturbation, ex nk. F. Okay, so that's just standard first order perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. And it turns out that this electric field, the ratio of the induced current to the electric field can be written in a special way, and I can see that by first of all using two tricks. Okay. First of all, I want to know the matrix element of the position operator between block states, And I can do that. I can calculate that related to matrix elements of the velocity operator by using the fact that the velocity operator is the time derivative of the position operator. And in quantum mechanics, the time derivative is calculated by taking the commutator with the Hamiltonian. And so that means this perturbation I can write in terms of velocity operator. And if I calculate the Hamiltonian, when the Hamiltonian's on the left, it acts on this block, eigenstate, gives me an energy, and similarly on the right, so the matrix element of the position operator that appears in this perturbation theory is the same as the matrix element of the velocity operator, except that there's an extra energy denominator that appears. So instead of 1 over energy to the first power, I get 1 over energy to the second power. So let's call this A, trick A. There's another trick B. So these are actually commonly used trick in electron transport theory. And my colleague, Chun Nu, who was here last week, worked on what I'm really deriving here is an expression for the quantum Hall effect that was originally derived by David Thallus, and my colleague Chun Nu worked with him for his thesis. And he told him that when they were working on this, David Thallus told him that he had colleagues who could use these two tricks to prove that anything was an insulator. You can prove anything at all. But in any event, let me do trick B, which is DDKX. Let me consider the following thing. Okay, I should have mentioned, of course, that when I did this is just standard perturbation theory, but I used one property here, and that's the velocity operator is diagonal in this Hilbert space, diagonal in the wave vector label. Trick B here, when I take this derivative, I can differentiate the wave functions here, which are my periodic wave functions, or I can differentiate the Hamiltonian. So let me take, let me first observe, these are n prime here, and n are two different band indices. So the Hamiltonian acting on any of these states gives a number, the eigenvalue times these states, and these states are orthogonal. So that is actually equal to zero. Okay? And we want to write zero in another form, and we're going to write zero form in another form. And let me change notation a little bit. So I'm taking the derivative with respect to the parameter kx, the block wave x component of the block wave vector. And I'm going to write that as derivative with respect to x acting on this periodic wave function for band n prime. So when the derivative acts on the first term, the Hamiltonian acting on the second term will give me the energy. The eigenenergy for that block state. When the derivative acts on the second term, I can let the Hamiltonian act to the left, and it gives me the block energy, the band energy of the block state on the left. Okay? And since this inner product between block states in different bands is equal to zero, the derivative acting on the Bra side or the Ket side of this, they just differ by a sign. So I've grouped those first terms together. And the derivative of the Hamiltonian with derivative acts on the Hamiltonian itself, that's what I showed you at the beginning, that the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to this wave vector, derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to momentum, actually is the velocity operator. So this is The third term is n prime k. The interband velocity operator. So for any crystal, the interband velocity operator is related in this way, by this equation, to the difference between the band energies, and something that has to do with how the block states depend on momentum. Okay? I have to probably say some more words if the bands are degenerate. But if the bands are degenerate, they're not. What we're going to end up here is with contributions from bands on opposite sides of the Fermi energy. Okay, so if the bands are degenerate, which does happen occasionally at some points in the Brouwer zone, then I have to say some extra words here, but nothing changes substantially. Mm-hmm. If where?
A gives you an expression for dx in terms of x.
Yeah.
B gives you the same expression for dx in terms of dk.
DDK, yeah. So, you know, so in some sense, this is saying, yes, okay, in a crystal. I think it's not so obvious in a crystal, but it maybe what you're saying is it might have been said more elegantly, and that's probably true. More trickily. What? So A, if you put those expressions together, what you get is that the Hall conductivity is equal to E squared over H, summing over momentum, and it turns out that what you get when you put these factors together is you get a sum over occupied states of the imaginary part of something which this quantity is the momentum space Berry curvature you can show that this quantity this quantity you can easily show is the curl in momentum space of curl of the derivative with respect to momentum of the wave function in a given band, and so it it tells you how the wave function this quantity is dependent just on how the wave function of the block electrons is varying in momentum space, and in particular the integral of the over the full Brouwer zone of this since this is the phase of the wave function and basically it's the curl of this Berry curvature, it follows from an index, or the Sheva-Singer index theorem, that the integral over the full Brouwer zone of this is 2 pi times an integer. So it turns out that the Hall conductivity of a full band, just calculated from perturbation theory, is E squared over H times an integer. And what's surprising about this, different from what we're used to in transport theory, is you can see that this kind of current response to an electric field is actually induced coherence between different bands. And it can even be non-zero in an insulator. And this is very different from the way we usually think about transport. In a metal, I told you that block states carry a velocity. And if you can occupy the block, more block states with one sign of velocity than with another, you get a net current. And that's how we normally think about transport in a metal. Here we can have a current response even in an insulator, even though that we know if we occupy all of the states in a band of an insulator and add up all of the velocities add to zero. This current response is coming because of, as I said, because of induced coherence between different bands. And so how can it be that the Hall conductivity of an insulator can be zero? Well, it turns out that you can show that if you have, in order for this Hall conductivity response coefficient to be non-zero, you have to break time reversal symmetry. So if I have a ferromagnetic system, ferromagnets, by occupying more of one spin than another, spontaneously break time reversal symmetry, and they can have a non-zero Hall conductivity. But paramagnets, in the absence of an external magnetic field, can't have a non-zero Hall conductivity. So that means if I have a ferromagnetic insulator, in principle, I can have a non-zero Hall conductivity. Okay, it's allowed. The only thing is, we don't know any examples of this. So one of the objectives of this workshop is partly maybe to find examples of ferromagnetic insulators where the Hall conductivity is different from zero. And we almost have an example. What I've been talking about so far is the current, charge current. And as I said, charge current, charge Hall current, can only be non-zero if you break time reversal symmetry. But spin current, because if I calculate the current of spins, then the spin current can be non-zero even without breaking time reversal symmetry. Yeah. That's right. So if this is an insulator, for example, then a typical the typical energy scales, anyway, for solids are EVs, which are 10 to the 4th degrees Kelvin. So room temperature is low temperature. That's the brief answer. OK. So as I say, unfortunately, so far, nature hasn't given us ferromagnetic insulators that have a non-zero spin Hall or quantum Hall effect. Maybe we'll be able to manufacture materials in the future that have this property. But nature has almost given us a system that's not ferromagnetic, that's paramagnetic, and it has a quantum spin Hall effect. This is an observation of Charlie Kane going back to some earlier work. by Gordon Semenoff and others. Graphene is two-dimensional carbon material. It actually turns out that the carbon atoms in graphene, which are basically sheets of graphite, are located on a honeycomb lattice. And this is what a honeycomb lattice looks like. repeated forever. And it turns out a honeycomb lattice, in the language we use to classify crystals, is a lattice with two atoms per unit cell, A atom and a B atom. And so there are two carbon atoms for each region in space which has a periodic potential. And you can show that the effective Hamiltonian in this K dot P sense that I was describing before for graphene turns out that the Hamiltonian, well, it actually looks like this. I'll explain what these symbols mean in a second. It has Dirac-like band structure, and there's with a mass term that looks like this. Okay, so that's the K dot P Hamiltonian of graphite. These sigma X and sigma Y are two-component Pauli spin matrices that describe the degree of freedom of these two atoms per unit cell. It turns out that there are two different places in the Brouwer zone of graphite where you have low energy states. And this is, in the jargon of semiconductor physics, those are referred to as valleys in K-space. And there are two different valleys represented by this quantum number tau z. And of course, there's also a spin degree of freedom. And at low energies, the spin there is a spin orbit coupling term in the Hamiltonian of graphene, which takes this form. Okay, so this is the Hamiltonian. You can see that in this two atoms per unit cell space, what this corresponds to is a sigma X, if I call sigma X and sigma Y, these two atoms per unit cell, a pseudospin degree of freedom, then this is like a momentum-dependent magnetic field that either points in the direction of K or direction of K in a different valley reflected in the KX equals zero plane. So the eigenstate, the Bloch eigenstate, is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, which is I can think of as some momentum-dependent magnetic field. And what happens is if I look at the bands of graphene, ignoring this spin orbit coupling term, so this is E in that direction and versus K in that direction, and this is the zero energy state, and this term will create an effective magnetic field that points in the z direction. These effective magnetic fields point in the xy directions. And as I go around a circle in momentum space, these components of the effective magnetic field go around a circle once. So this the eigenstates, the Bloch eigenstates, are basically spin a half, pseudospin a half, spin coherent states. And the Berry phase associated with them is well known. And so if I at K equals zero, when this term is absent, this effective magnetic field points to either the North Pole or the South Pole. Or if I go far away from zero energy, this effective magnetic field is pointing in the XY plane and going around a circle with the direction of K. So you can easily calculate from that For graphene, if I calculate this, the Hall conductivity contribution coming from a particular spin and a particular value, I get E squared over H, actually turns out times a half. So this, one of the amusing things about graphene is that it apparently appears to break the rule that the Hall coefficient has to be quantized in integer multiples of E squared over H, which actually is just one way of understanding why there always have to be two of these valleys in the Brouwer zone. So you get times two. So it turns out that with this effect of Hamiltonian, graphene, let me put in the spin orbit coupling. Perfect graphene has a small gap in its band structure. If I calculate for a given value of the spin, if I calculate the Hall conductivity from the occupied states below this gap, I get a quantized Hall conductance. So a very common material, graphite, or carbon in this graphite form, if I have a single sheet, it turns out that if I look at one spin at a time, it gives us an example. It's an example, basically, of an insulator which has a quantized Hall conductivity. It's the only example that I know of. It doesn't. The two spin states give opposite Hall conductivities, and one of the interesting, peculiar things about this type of transport is it's paradoxical that I can have an insulator with no states at the Fermi energy, and I can have a Hall conductivity, which means that I can have a small difference in chemical potential between two electrodes, source and drain. Small difference, much smaller, let's say, than the gap of the material, and I can still have a Hall conductivity. That's peculiar, and it actually has given rise in the quantum Hall literature to endless discussion and debate. But the basic answer, basic way out of this conundrum is whenever you have a quantized Hall conductance, either in a magnetic insulator, as I said, we don't know any examples of that, or in graphene, you have to have, whenever this Hall quantum number is non-zero, that means that you have to have states that are localized at the edge of the system. And it's really those edge states that carry these currents. And so one of the objectives of the spintronics program in this spin Hall effect area is to find other useful examples of situations where we can tune a parameter in the system and open up a gap with this funny topological property, which gives rise to a quantum spin Hall effect. When you have an edge state, the simplest possible edge state that you can have is basically a single state that can carry current, and a single quantum channel for carrying current. And so if you can control, for example, with a gate, whether or not such a gap opens up, or whether a gap exists in a material that has this topological property or doesn't have this topological property, then you have the perfect quantum mechanical switch. And so that's, we heard, for example, from Chucheng Zhang last week, some speculations of trying to realize new systems and where we can have these types of switches. Turns out this gap in graphene may be too small to make this effect useful in graphene, but it would be nice to do it, for example, and we have Lawrence Mollenkamp here this week from Würzburg. One of the potential materials to open up this type of gap is certain types of semiconductors known as inverted gap semiconductors in quantum wells, and I think there's great potential for finding this type of effect.
How do you understand rules look like at the top of the valence band and the bottom of the induction band. So you would understand what's going on here from that point of view. A chemist wouldn't like a picture you've drawn. Carbon doesn't like to have three bonds, right? So there's something missing here in terms
right.
of the structure.
Yeah, so you know what's missing is there are lots of states, bonding states down below the Fermi energy.
These just kind of thinking of the Homo-Lumo structure, which is the way maybe chemists would kind of look at it. The top of the valence band, the bottom of the conduction band. That's kind of the key symmetries there, right?
So these...
To make currents and so forth. A little 2x2 semiconductor thing with the orthogonal term of the moon and the K. It's the expectation value of those make the current flow and so forth.
Yeah, it's these states that are near the Fermi energy are actually pi orbitals. They're p orbitals that are oriented out of the plane, and the thing that makes the thing that controls whether or not you have edge states, whether you have this current, is how this gap is opened. Okay, and this. So there are I don't know if I can say anything really simple, but
does your group have any chemists, theoretical chemists on board?
Well, there's you know, there's nothing surprising about this. I mean, what's surprising about this is not the band structure, which is present in models people have used for graphene for a long time. What's different is the realization that whether or not there are edge states in this small gap that's opened up here by spin orbit coupling depends on the way you know how these states on these pi orbitals are coupled together, and gives rise to topological properties of the bands. I'm not sure if yeah. So that's the best I can do. We can try again afterwards. Uh-huh.
In systems like this, is there any kind of monkey business possible with wrapping things in tubes?
Wrapping things into tubes?
Yeah, which is sort of constraint.
Well, certainly, you know, if there are edge states, then it's connected to how the bands, the boundary conditions for wrapping them into tubes. So.
Yeah, right, exactly. So there are lots of things that might come into it. You can start with tubes instead of machines. What would it change the constraints on the system?
If I wrapped it into tubes, I wouldn't have any edge states.
Right.
And this...
But obviously, the tube gets infinitely big dot, dot, dot. So somewhere maybe things happen.
Yeah, so if I wrapped it into tubes, then if I go around the Brouhaha zone or you know, change the flux through the tube, then I would see certain peculiar properties associated with how charge moves around the tube when I, as a function of flux through the tube, for example. And the way that appears in a real physical system, which, I mean, carbon nanotubes, of course, are graphene sheets around in tubes, and this is connected to spin orbit coupling in carbon nanotubes. In carbon nanotubes, they probably don't do anything particularly interesting, this particular spin orbit coupling. But if I have a graphene sheet, then they do something interesting because the way in which this gap opens controls whether or not I have edge states. So I can change the conductance, if you like, from 1 to 0. Okay, and yeah, go ahead.
So how actually delta enters in the final result? We don't want delta to be zero, right? But we don't want delta to be very large as well.
Why don't we? We'd like it to be very large, actually.
Yes.
But anyway, why do you say that?
I thought that the perturbation theory may not be working.
If it's too big, then the gap is so large that different regions of momentum states may be important. That far away from this particular point where the energy is close to zero. So that's true.
Do you have analytic expressions to delta of your response function?
For delta?
No, through delta.
For the dependence on delta.
Yes.
Right, so the spin Hall conductivity, the Hall conductivity in Brench, given Brench, doesn't depend on delta ideally. But in practice, there will be other energy scales that are important, like potentially electron-electron interactions, and certainly electron disorder energy scales that you can never make perfect crystalline graphene. And those disorder energy scales are it seems, much bigger than this gap at present. And so the spin Hall conductivity basically goes down like delta divided by, let's say, gamma, where gamma is some disorder energy scale when the disorder energy scale is large. So that's the situation that we're in now. This effect has not been seen, actually. This spin Hall conductivity in graphene has not been seen yet, and people are trying to see it as we speak. Yes?
I wanted to ask a question about opening the gap at the risk of introducing a language barrier. Let me just say it the way I would say it, and then I can try to rephrase it. When the gap is open, is there a Chern number representing, a Chern number plus or minus 1 representing the difference between the upper and lower gap?
Not quite. There's actually a Chern number, if you like, almost a Chern number plus or minus a half.
Well, for at each Dirac point.
Yeah, that's right.
If you fully resolve the degeneracy,
that's right.
Plus or minus 1.
That's right, yeah. Michael?
The edge states are they chiral, so that spin up goes one way around and spin down the other way around?
Yeah, so in this model that was studied by Charlie Kane, the edge states are chiral, but there are two branches of edge states which are time reverse counterparts of each other. There's a spin up state going in one direction and a spin down state going in the other direction. One of the things that needs to be understood more generally, and Xuching Zhang, who was here last week, is making efforts in that direction. If I really have spin orbit coupling, it turns out by symmetry that at this particular point in the Brouin zone where the band energies go to zero, that the spin orbit Hamiltonian is proportional to the z component of spin. Now, this is partly due to the fact that these are pi orbitals pointed outside of this graphene plane. But this is basically spin orbit coupling, and in a crystal it will never be true throughout the entire Brouin zone. Coming back to your question, a comment, this model is in part a fiction, because when I go through k-space going from one critical point, one Dirac point to another Dirac point, the spin orbit Hamiltonian will not just be proportional to Sz. There's in this model Hamiltonian, the z component of total spin is a good quantum number. That won't be true in practice. So there's a need for a more general way to say what is the character of the edge states.
But to make contact into another area, this sounds very much like the Callan-Harvey effect from string theory, right? Where you have a 2 plus 1 dimensional Dirac equation, you have a mass implied electric field where the current's in this direction, and if you have a region where the mass changes sign, you get a chiral mode which kind of accumulates things there.
Yeah, so that's, the origin of, recognition of this special property of graphene goes back, as far as I'm aware, to a paper by Gordon Semenoff, where he was basically making precisely that kind of analogy. And anyway, this is perhaps this work by Charlie Kane is perhaps the identification of the in principle, the observable that's most closely connected to that. Okay, so my time is up.
Yeah, and I think it's a good place to stop where we had the first for-profit application period.
No, nobody's made any money out of string theory yet, but I hope it will be true.